You're now listening to Mixed Mental Arts with Brian Callen and Hunter Motz.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Mixed Mental Arts. Brian Callen, that absentee father, is not here with us. But that's okay, because I have someone much more interesting with me. Jordan from The Art of Charm. So, Jordan.
I'm here.
And Jordan, by the way, just so you know, is teaching me how to use Zoom. So that we can actually record this, because Jordan is a way better podcaster than I am.
So far. I'm just basically all I'm trying to do is make sure that your input on this thing is not going to like blow out everyone's eardrums, especially mine.
See, these are things that Brian Callen and I don't do. Like, some episodes are way too quiet, and some episodes are way too loud, and then I have this awful laugh, and sometimes I do it directly into the mic, and that just sort of explodes everybody's eardrums. So this is why, this is one of the reasons why I wanted to have Jordan on the show, is because...
To troubleshoot your audio setup?
Well, not to be free tech support, but also just to tell people about, you know, how have you built, you know, a successful podcast, because yours makes money, ours loses money.
Oh, you should try doing that the other way around.
Oh, really? Yeah. Is it better when you have money coming in?
It is better.
Oh,
that,
wow.
That took me a long time to learn that lesson, too.
So, yeah, I think, you know, part of what one of the more interesting conversations that I had recently on Facebook was, we were talking about favorite podcasts, and we were also talking about, you know, what is the podcaster's experience? Because podcasters, you know, we interview so many people, we talk to so many people from different fields, and so we often have this sort of 10,000-foot view of what's going on, and we see large patterns that people maybe mired in a particular field don't have. And, you know, Tim Ferriss has written his book Tools of Titans, which just sort of draws together what have all these people taught him. And so I thought, well, part of what we're going to start doing is interviewing other podcasters to hear what insights have they gleaned from. How many episodes has Art of Charm done now?
Well, we just released episode, which interview 600 today, but I also have, I think, 100 and some change fan mail episodes, which I do Fan Mail Friday, where I answer people's letters that are about, like, hey, I'm at work and my boss keeps passing me up for a promotion and I think it's because I, you know, I'm gay or something like that. And I'm like, oh, God. So we try to solve that in a ideally not trite way, and giving real advice. And a lot of times I'll call guests back to the show to answer the letters that I get from listeners. So instead of me going, well, that sounds like a big problem, Jim, good luck with it, it's like, okay, let me have on... If you're going to talk about this person not being able to present well, or you have to give a presentation, you're freaking out, I might just have a really great presenter who you'd never be able to just call and ask him that question, and then I'll collect and curate all the questions that have to do with that. Or I'll get somebody who's like Oprah's love coach, and I'll have that person answer all the breakup questions and things like that. And it tends to be really cool, because you can get somebody who's like, well, in my, I know you don't understand my world, but in my area, of race car driving. And I'm like, here's Jeff Gordon answering your question about race car driving. And it's like, holy crap. So it's kind of about access. So to answer your question, I don't know, 700-800 episodes, more than, 800 in change, maybe 1,000. Close to it if you add up all the bonus stuff over the years. But for doing the show, it's about access to great knowledge and great people and great high performers. And that's been important over the years, because when we started our show, there was much more of a, let's just record ourselves in my friend's basement and upload it to the internet. And that was fine 10 years ago when we started. Now, if you're recording a conversation with you and your buddy in your basement, your buddy better be somebody who's pretty damn interesting, and you better have something to offer as well, because now it's just not, let's have some talk radio. It's what makes you different from the other, and I'm going off memory here, 350,000 shows in iTunes.
Yeah.
And if the answer is, we do ours in next to a beach, or, well, we're just both really funny, what's going to happen with your show is it's going to get canned, and by canned, you're going to give up because no one's listening. There's no one to cancel you now, for better or for worse.
But I think that's what's so great is that, you know, speaking in an evolutionary sense, we sort of had this pre-Cambrian explosion of podcasts, right? And there's so much diversity, and there's so many things being tried out, and, you know, some will succeed, some will fail, but there's an evolutionary process where, you know, people get weeded out. I mean, frankly, Brian Callen and I should have stopped podcasting a long, long time ago, because we've been losing money for a long time. And, you know, I mean, it was very much for us, the experience was the ability to connect with all of these great thinkers. And so initially it was just very much about, these are people we wanted to talk to. And then, you know, people started listening and started engaging with it. And I think what's great is there are so many different paths that, you know, you can take, and there is an evolution. Because I think what's interesting about The Art of Charm is, you know, where did it start out from? Like, what were you originally trying to do?
Yeah, that's an interesting question that nobody really ever asks. Yeah. They usually go, how did you get to where you are today?
Yeah,
nobody ever goes, what were you doing back then?
That's right.
And that's, of course, Hunter Matz with the good question. What was going on in our lives at that point was I was in law school. My buddy AJ, who I think you'd walked past.
I think we may have even shook hands. There may have been a moment.
There you go.
You know.
So what was happening is he was a cancer biologist, and uh-huh. I was a law student. And I had done a 2L summer. So second year, you get hired by some law firm that basically wants to wine and dine you and be like, working on Wall Street is so easy. All you do is go see Blue Man Group and eat oysters. And so I was like, great. Okay, cool. And then I realized that I wasn't really getting any mentorship from the guy who hired me. And in fact, not only was I not getting any mentorship from this guy, he was never in the office. And for a lawyer, that's weird. Because mm-hmm. when you think about bankers and lawyers, they exist in the office. We bill in 6-minute increments. We bill investment banks that have bottomless pockets. So when you get hired for real as a lawyer, they want you there 24/7 mm-hmm. until you just you have to sleep because your body gives out, because you're billing hours the whole time. So the fact that Dave, what his name was never in the office, let alone not at 3 a.m. on a Sunday night like everyone else, let alone at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday, where the hell is this guy? So HR made him take me out for coffee to like check off the mentorship box mm-hmm. on some document. And he took me out for coffee and he's banging away on his BlackBerry. And he goes, all right, ask me anything you want. You know, just kind of like ask me some crap about financial derivatives or something. And I said, how come you're never in the office, but you're still a partner? I don't understand. Do you just work from home all the time? And he was a little annoyed, and I thought, maybe I'm going to get fired for asking this question. But I also thought, who cares? I need to know the answer to this, because what the hell's happening here? And this is a guy from Brooklyn with a tan, so he clearly has a secret, right? I want to know what's going on. And he said, oh, you know, I just don't worry about billing hours because I bring in a lot of deals. And mm-hmm. when I bring in deals, I get a bonus for that, and so it's more money than worrying about billable hours. And since other guys in the firm are having trouble bringing in deals, it's better for me to do it and for them to worry about the papers and the documents and things like that. And I thought, hang on a second here. I was able to coast by on I hate saying things like brain power because it makes me sound smarter than I am. It's a little mm-hmm. self-aggrandizing. I was smart enough in high school to coast through it and get good grades or okay grades and be fine. And then in college, I wasn't smart enough to do that, but I was able to outwork all these kids who were, for the first time, drunk off their ass every day and not at home with supervision. So
whereas
I could just outwork
you'd be drunk
them.
Out off your ass all through high school, so you had experience
right.
with being drunk off your
exactly.
ass.
Exactly. I'm like, I can read anthropology wasted, no problem. So I basically just went that route. And then in law school, a lot of the smart kids who were there were kind of like, I'm so sick of working my ass off. I'm just going to be – we're all going to be lawyers at the end. We're not going to fail out of here. I'm fine. And so I outworked them, and I ended up on Wall Street. Well, the problem with Wall Street is you can't outwork everyone, and you're certainly not smarter than everyone if you're me. Mm-hmm. So I lost my competitive advantage, both of them, that I'd ever had in my whole life. And what Dave was sort of telling me was, hey, there's this other competitive advantage that I have that other people don't have that got me not only to the top of the law game faster, but I can write my own ticket and I make more money than these people and I don't have to sit in this office because I can go play golf and do jujitsu and go out on boats and stuff with investment bankers and I'm more valuable that way. And I thought, wait just a second. If I focus on that skill set, I don't have to worry about we call this imposter syndrome, but it's basically they're going to figure out that I don't belong here and they're going to fire me,
right.
Which is where my head was at, not realizing there was a secret third path to success on Wall Street in this game. So I dedicated my life to soft skills instead of technical skills, which was nobody was ever talking about this. They weren't saying you need to learn how to build relationships. You need people to get to know, like, and trust you. Nobody was talking about that. So The Art of Charm started off as, hey, we can teach you body language, nonverbal communication, vocal tonality, eye contact, and things like that. And then after the first few episodes, people were like, yeah, how do I use it to get women? How do I use it to get women? How do I use it to get women? And I was like, well, if you're asking, I'll try to find that out, because that's another problem that we all have at age 24,
right.
25. So we started to do a lot of the dating stuff. And the reason that we aren't doing the dating stuff as much now is because at some point—
because you're married.
Well, yes. Partially because I'm married, but also because, frankly, the dating stuff that we were doing was really effective, but then this sort of pickup artist-y movement came into play, and we were like, ugh, we don't want to be associated with those guys because it's creepy and it's misogynist. And the problem is, if you're the drug dealer, you can't be like, but I'm the good guy drug dealer.
Right.
You're still associated with all of the other people doing the creepy, rapey stuff.
Right. Pablo Escobar did try and do that. He was like,
I'm the good guy.
Good drug dealer.
Still died on a roof in Colombia, right? So in Medellin or something like that. So we just kind of went, all right, look, we have relationships that we're in. The dating stuff has been covered. And frankly, if I want to talk about networking, relationship development, creating friendships and relationships and business development, people who want to apply it to the dating and personal world, it's going to be like 99% overlap. They're going to figure it out and we can mention it here and there. But what we don't want to do is brand as these like dating or pickup guys, because when I try to get a guest on, like Jason Silva, who I just talked to, are you familiar with him?
Yeah, obviously.
So I had him on the show. I'm going to guess that if we were like, oh, yeah, we teach guys how to bang chicks, he would have been like, I'm going to pass on going on The Art of Charm. But we were able to have like the Sam Harris and the Jason Silva and the Shaquille O'Neal because the branding has changed. But back then we thought, we're going to teach networking, we're going to teach relationship development, wait, just kidding, let's teach a bunch of dating stuff. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, whoops, that was a little tangent, let's get back to our original focus.
Okay, that's, I think, really helpful to know, because I know, for example, when you reached out to me to talk about the Straight A Conspiracy, I was slightly perplexed, mm-hmm. because at that time, I think you were probably going through that transition.
We were, the rebranding. And this is, what, 5 years ago?
Years ago. So, and I think it's also interesting to know what the genesis of it was, because the point is that what it really comes out of is that it is this area of education that nobody talks about in high school or in college.
Yeah.
And, in particular, to connect this all to the science that we've been talking about on the Brian Callen Show, which is now Mixed Mental Arts, you know, there's this great book, Joe Henrich's The Secret of Our Success, which is about, you know, why did humans outstrip all other species on the planet? And there's this figure in there that I talk about all the time, which is that if you give an IQ test to a human toddler, a chimp, and an orangutan, then in causal intelligence, in spatial intelligence, and in quantitative intelligence, we are no smarter than a chimp or an orangutan at birth.
Is causal intelligence like, hey, when you push that thing, it goes that way?
That's right. Okay. Cause and effect.
Got it.
So, you know, these are the things that science tends to focus on heavily, on causal intelligence, right? Why do things fall down? You know, why do people get sick and die? Oh, it turns out to be germs. And so, you know, we suck at those things at birth. In fact, in many areas, we're actually worse than the chimp and the orangutan at birth.
Huh.
But there's one area in which we're off the charts, and that is social intelligence. And so what that social intelligence empowers is that it empowers the ability to form alliances and relationships, to form tribes, to form these big networks, right? We can transcend sort of our Dunbar number of 150 people and form these massive confederations that, you know, like the Genghis Khan Mongols, you know, they band together and they sweep out across the earth. But crucially, it enables us to pick up culture. And to learn from others. And so I think that's part of what's interesting is that, you know, this experience that you had with Dave, you know, you're like, Dave is failing at his job of mentoring me. And then you guys are forced together. And then what's interesting is that, you know, Dave changed your life. And that's great teaching because, you know, rather than spending hours and hours and hours and hours with you, in one conversation, Dave taught you more than probably most of your teachers in high school or college did.
And it was a freaking accident. Because what everybody asks when I go on those, like, mentorship shows or shows, they go, so then Dave took you under his wing and showed you how it's done? And I'm like, no, Dave picked up his BlackBerry, probably, like, didn't even pay for the coffee that we had. Left the office, went back up in the elevator and went, oh, I'm so glad that's over. What a knucklehead. And then, like, bailed, and I saw him twice in my life after that.
Amazing.
One time that was really funny, though, was that I'd seen him at the end was I'd already left the law firm. That thing was going downhill. The econ crash of 2008 had hit, was in full swing. He walked out of that firm, and he walked into another firm as a partner because he had all the book of business.
Yeah.
All the other partners were punished by the recession. So I saw that happen firsthand, and I was like, networking skills for sure.
Yeah.
The next time I saw him after that was we had moved The Art of Charm, the show that we were just talking about that I'd started in the basement. We moved that to Sirius XM Satellite Radio,
mm-hmm.
and I saw Dave in the elevator, and he went, hey, because he didn't even remember my name. And I was like, Dave. And he goes, yeah, I know you from, where do I know you from? I was like, oh, I used to work at Thatcher Prophet and Wood. And he goes, oh, yeah, what are you doing here? Are you coming to the firm that he was at? I won't mention the name because he might still be there. And I was dressed in like jeans and a, you know, dressed like I am now in a t-shirt and jeans. And I was like, no, I'm not doing that. And he kind of got relieved because I think he was like, am I going to have to fire you for coming to work like that? And I go, no, I work on the top floor. I've got my radio show up there. And he goes, oh, like, you're the only other person I know that's employed now.
Wow.
After that, because everyone got just bent over by this recession.
Right.
And it was funny because, like, him and I were the only people that we know that landed on their feet at all at that point in time. Oh, plenty of other people got jobs later, naturally, but we were the only other people. And it was just kind of funny because neither of us saw – we weren't working at this other firm, which then had eventually gone out of business. And it's just the reason he was able to then land on his feet was because of that. And the reason I was able to have a radio show about this was because I actually listened to what the hell he said and then went – okay, that's my entire focus. Because I figured even if I were staying in the law game, which at that point, of course, I wasn't, but when Dave told me this thing, I thought, before anybody even realizes this skill set exists, I might have 4, 5, 6 years to practice this. Mm. And then when the other people go, how come I'm not a junior partner? How come I'm not a counsel? It'll be like, oh, I have to make relationships with people and bring in clients. Oh, I guess I'll learn that. And that's going to take them a long time. But if I've got a 4, 5, 6 year jump on these guys and girls, then I actually might be at that point smarter than them when it comes to the soft skill set, because I realize these are naturally talented people. They're all sharp. They all work their butts off. If they're rowing in that direction, the only chance in hell I have of survival in this business is to row in a different direction and do it really well.
Well, but I think crucially, let's talk about that different direction, because that direction, I mean, that's humanity's superpower. And the, you know, I think what's odd is that we have a society that sort of doesn't value that and doesn't focus on that, when that is really how we learn and that is really how we progress. Is it's like there's someone, you're like, you clearly have it figured out. I want to learn what you know, even if you're not learning it directly from Dave, right? He sort of defines the playing field. And then you're like, okay, rather than just getting mentored by you, I'm going to go get mentored by 1,000 of the best people at this in different areas.
Exactly. And had there been podcasts back when we started our podcast that talked about this, it would have been a game changer, because the only even mentors, and I put that in lame air quotes, right? Because the only mentors we had is like, all right, go out and read Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Great book, but man, 1938, like it's a little bit out of date.
Right.
And not a lot of the concepts are fine, you know,
sure.
But a lot of what was in there was, you need a firm handshake and you need great eye contact. And I even took Dale Carnegie classes all over the United States with different teachers and people that have won awards and little offshoots of Dale Carnegie. And then it really was a joke for AJ and I when we started the Art of Charm podcast, because we thought, look, if people don't like you, it sure as shit isn't because you don't have a firm handshake or you have mediocre eye contact. If you got passed up for a promotion and it's not in a sales role or something like that, if you got passed up for a managerial position, it's not because people were like, I'm really on the fence with this Hunter guy, but he had a great handshake. Screw it. C-suite that guy right there.
Or just looking for tensile strength, right? Like, why do we even have job interviews? We should just have one of those hand squeezers, like, you know, and then you can see, like,
go get a hand grip.
Push the love meter up. And if you do, it could be the job meter too.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And so what we started to see was like, all right, this advice is okay, probably pretty basic, but it never attacks the real cause of the problem. Like, if you meet, you probably have guys, I've got guy friends, they're still single and stuff like that, and not by choice.
I'm still single.
But, like, you're maybe enjoying that. You're not like some weird dude who
can't
socialize.
Things that I'm focused on. And yeah.
But, like, we've got friends, that, and I'm sure you and I both have friends where we're like, yeah, the reason that Jim is single is because he's got all kinds of ish going on that he's not addressing. And it's not his handshake, and it's not his eye contact. It's the way he relates to people, the insecure things he does when he's nervous, the situations he gets himself in.
He thinks about the opposite sex.
Exactly. The mindsets and the paradigms he's got when he thinks about that stuff, which were formed and informed by the relationship with his parents and with his brother and with his aunt and his mom. And, like, nobody wants to go in and talk about that. They want to go, oh, you know what? You need clothes that fit better and you need to make sure that you put gel in your hair. And it's like, no. There's plenty of people that put gel in their hair and have tailored suits that have no friends. friends, no social life, and it's not because of that nor the handshake and the eye contact. There's something else going on. So we decided to go and figure out what those things were,
mm-hmm.
and even just talking with therapists and talking with thought leaders and authors and coaches and military personnel, and we're like, what is it that you're doing at the CIA that's getting you rapport with all these people who know that you're getting information from them, right?
Yep.
Like, what is the intelligence gathering process like, and how can we apply that to job interviews, business, dating, whatever? And that's the stuff that works, because the frickin' Green Berets aren't going through the Dale Carnegie course learning how to have a firm handshake and great eye contact before they go to Afghanistan.
But they do love hair gel.
They
do. There's a lot of hair gel.
There's container ships full of hair gel in Afghanistan.
That are really the secret to taking down Osama bin Laden. So, yeah, I mean, what you're talking about is substance over style.
Right.
And, you know, the style matters. It's important, you know, first impressions. But I think, in general, there's, you know, the last decade has been such a decade of style. And, you know, there's been this real superficiality to a lot of things in terms of news, in terms of who our celebrities are. I mean, dare I say it, Kim Kardashian.
Yes.
You know, what is going on, you know, deep inside Kim Kardashian, we don't know. But I think that that paper tiger, that sort of very, you know, thin, superficial image is increasingly becoming unsatisfying to people. People want some sort of authentic connection. They want to understand what's really going on with someone. And crucially, you know, what they want is that they don't want the illusion of success. They want that real path to mastery. They want the internal part of that. And so what have you figured out after 1,000 episodes? What are these big secrets? Spill the dish.
Sure. So a lot of what this comes down to, and it's, again, it's going to sound a little bit what do you call it? There's the word when you go, hey, it's not about eye contact and firm handshake. But here's the other quick weird tip
that I'm going to give you
where it's like, okay, bullshitter. You know, you just talked about how it's not these one or two little things
and now
you're going to give us one or two little things. And so I just want to frame the context, which is that what we can talk about now is not going to be like, this is the real secret. The real secret is years of working on yourself and introspection.
But there are things that you're aiming at. I mean, it's
sure.
You know, these principles take years and years to like actually really apply. But what are the things? I think that's part of the interesting question. Is, you know, so you know, Daniel Kahneman of Thinking Fast and Slow, right? He has this heuristics, rules of thumb, and so there are these key ways of thinking that we use again and again to sort of suss out situations. So what are the heuristics that, you know, after 1,000 episodes, or you're still using? Or that really sort of inform your thinking?
Sure. So one of the things that came up in my interview with Jason Silva today as well was that we're not who we think we are. We're not who other people think we are. We actually are a sort of hybrid mental model of what other we think other people think we are.
Yeah.
So we kind of, I'm thinking, and I know that sounds really complex, so I'll sort of try to frame this more simply. Basically, the person who I am is not the opinion I have of myself, nor the opinion that you, Hunter, have of me. It's the opinion that I have of your opinion of me. But, of course, I don't know really what your opinion of me is. So it's basically my hypothesis about your hypothesis about me,
right?
Which is complex. But when you break that down, what that does for us is it starts to say, okay, so essentially our realities are all subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only a few concrete tricks that our brain uses to figure out who people are quickly enough to not die readily by becoming getting proximity to somebody who's going to smash our head in with a rock or whatever. And so we're evolved to think this way. And one of those is nonverbal communication. And that's,
mm-hmm.
that's a whole huge, giant ship load of information. But one of the things that I like to give on sort of shows like this where people are going to actually freaking use it is we form all of our first impressions nonverbally. Big surprise, right?
Yeah.
We kind of know that, except when we're trying to solve problems involving nonverbal and verbal communication, we seem to somehow ignore that. So if we're thinking about this in a dating context, which I think is an interesting way to do it, a lot of men especially will say, okay, I want to go start a conversation with those women over there. Women will say, I don't know what to say when we start conversations with people. And you say something like, okay, well, I got to figure out what to say.
Mm.
And it's like, well, no, because if your goal is to start a conversation, you can pretty much do it by saying anything. I mean, conversations start all the time by that. We're not really trying to start a conversation. We're trying to create a favorable first impression when we start that conversation. The problem is, that's not your first impression.
Mm.
Your first impression is made when other people notice you. It's when other people, you become a blip on their radar.
Yeah.
And if you don't believe me, you can test this hypothesis right now, unless you're driving, by basically walking down the street or walking through the office or walking through the mall or wherever you are. If you listen to podcasts at the mall, which is weird, but there's definitely people that do that, right?
Well, how great would it be if instead of that shitty Muzak, they pumped out like some awesome podcast,
right,
like The Art of Charm?
Sure, or, I'd be down.
Yeah,
I'd be down for that.
It'd be much more interesting.
I would freely license my show to Hot Topic
or
Forever
Westfields.
21.
Yeah,
exactly.
But probably, you know, I don't know how that would affect people shopping. Would they shop more, or would they just be like listening to the podcast and not buying anything?
Yeah, they'd be like, "Sir, do you want to try on some shoes?"
No, this is a good bit.
Yeah. I'm learning how to recreate nonverbal communication signals. So it's when we become a blip on other people's radar,
right?
That's right. And so if we want to test that, we go and we walk through the mall, we walk through Westfield where they're playing The Art of Charm, and what we notice is that we're making judgments subconsciously about mm-hmm. everybody that we see. We can't help it. Even if you think, I'm not a judgy person, your brain subconsciously is still going, that person's really big. There's a child. This person's overweight. This person has tattoos on there. I'm going to move over there that mm-hmm. has teardrops and it's dark outside or something.
That's
on the
right.
street. So we do that, and it's evolved, and it's a safety thing primarily, and the rest of it has to do with social order and hierarchy, and social status is determined nonverbally. And if you don't believe me about social status being determined nonverbally, think about the last time somebody tried to tell you and explain to you why they were important and what your image of that person was
yep.
in your mind right after they did that, right? Like,
but I think what's interesting, let's just even unpack this, like mm-hmm. if you need me to explain this to you, right? Because so much of it is that, you know, even there you're fighting people's mental models, right?
Right,
you're fighting people's impressions of themselves, what they believe about reality, what they believe about how other people think. And I think the crucial thing, and you know, this is a large part of what we've been doing, you know, on the Brian Callen Now Mixed Mental Arts, is, you know, really just sort of trying to get to a more realistic view of human nature. How do humans actually work? And a lot of the things that you're doing are things that we do where, you know, we're just trying to get people to pay attention to what your own brain does.
Mm-hmm.
You are an actual human, listener. We are humans. And so, you know, there's rather than sort of having to go and make you read all these scientific journals, just watch what your own brain does. Watch how your own body behaves. And then all you have to do is just generalize that to the other 7 billion people on the planet. And some of that generalizing won't work out. Like some
right.
things won't cross apply. But that shared core humanity, a lot of those principles in terms of how your mind is instantly filling in and instantly categorizing and instantly assessing threats, that's going to generally apply. Different cultures will perceive different things as threats.
Exactly.
But the point is that it's that same humanity at work. And I think that's what's the interesting thing is, you know, you hear these terms like mindfulness.
Right.
Right.
Thank you for using
yeah,
the tone.
That voice. It's just like I really actually want to use the voice of my high school English teacher, who was this guy named Matthew Woodland, and he talked like this.
Oh, my God.
Talk about mindfulness. but, you know,
wow.
mindfulness is just like this terrible hippie spiritual term.
Right.
And it's literally just pay attention to what your brain is doing.
Like, yeah.
That's all it is.
Or not pay attention to anything your brain is doing and just be zen.
Yeah,
and then at that
exactly.
point, at that point, you lose me because I'm like, I can't do that. I'm
yeah.
super ADHD. That's why I talk for a living and listen sometimes for a living. It's otherwise impossible.
But yeah, it's, I mean, well, that's what you're talking about is like pay attention to what your brain is doing. And that is one of the best teachers you can find. And that's all Buddhism is really just you keep paying attention to how your brain works and you learn amazing things about human nature that you can then apply to the rest of the world.
It's really hard to shut off a lot of the programming. And that's, of course, goes along with the whole mindfulness thing. And so the reason that this is important, by
yeah.
the way, is because since we know that we make judgments about people when they see us and we make judgments or they make judgments about us when they see us as well. What we want to do is we realize, okay, well, if we're trying to make favorable first impressions, just for example, because it's an easy one to explain, then we're not supposed to control everything that comes out of our mouth during a conversation and be hyper aware of all of those things. What we really should work on is our nonverbal communication. And
mm-hmm.
since we also know that our nonverbal communication is a reflection of our internal state, which is, by the way, one of the reasons we evolved to be so adept at interpreting it, because we want to see if that person's actually dangerous. Because if we're wrong, oh well, we acted safely anyway. And if you, what's that example that Michael Shermer uses? If you hear a rumble in the bushes, you could think, it's just my friend playing a joke on me, but it could also be a lion. So let's just act like it's a lion. And our brains do that. We've evolved that way because everybody who thought, Jim, is that you in the bushes? They're all dead. You know, they're all dead.
And now comes Simba.
Yeah, yes. They're all toast. And they have been for millennia worth of generations. And so we know that we can control our nonverbal communication by figuring out how to relegate that to a level of habit. What we can't do is convincingly fake it. We know that it's really hard for the body to lie. We know that it's really hard for us to lie both with words and the body at the same time. That's why interrogators are always looking at nonverbal communication and things like that. And it's also why in a dating or work scenario, we often think like, that person's weird, or that person's creepy. What that usually means, we can't articulate it in the moment generally. What that means is that whatever's coming out of your mouth is incongruent with what your body is saying, and that's giving a danger signal to one of my lizard brain processes here, and so I'm just going to avoid. And so we also know that through controlling our nonverbal, basically our nonverbal communication, we can control those nonverbal first impressions, which are the real first impressions because we become a blip on other people's radar. And I have a drill for that, but I don't know if you want to go down that road yet. It's up to you. It's your show.
Well, the thing I wanted to, you know, my show belongs to the community.
That's
right. It doesn't belong to me. But the thing that I actually wanted to really unpack about that was when you were talking about interrogators, because we had Paul Ekman on the show, which was such a treat. You know, Paul Ekman is who Lie to Me is based on.
Right.
And he only gave us half an hour, but he's so awesome that we were like, oh, my God, we got half an hour with Paul Ekman. That's amazing.
Yes.
Like so much like verbal star, you know, intellectual star fucking went on.
Yes.
Like it was amazing. But one of the things that he talked about was, you know, just how ineffective interrogation and torture is, because obviously people, when they're being tortured, aren't going to tell you what's actually going on with them. And so the best interrogation technique is to be genuinely interested in what someone else has to say. And if people really feel like you really want to hear their story, they spill their guts. And I think that's what's fascinating is that, you know, so much of what I learned from that, and I think part of what you're saying is that, like, if you think you're going to fake people out or trick people, right, good luck.
Yeah, it's so hard.
It's you know, this lizard brain, right, has evolved just deliberately to detect bullshit. And not just to detect dangers out in the physical world, but dangers from other human beings who have killed probably more human beings than any other animal.
Absolutely.
And you're just not going to bullshit it. So the point is that you have to work towards being a genuine person. And it is cultivating more and more of that authenticity.
People who are really good at convincingly lying both with their body and with their words, it takes 13 takes, millions of dollars in camera equipment to capture, and then they win awards and get paid millions of dollars for doing it.
Yep. And their names are Brian Callen.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's like, he's the only one who can do it.
George
All other
Clooney.
Actors are hacks.
Yeah, and it's so hard. It's so hard to do that. The idea that you're going to be like, no, I'm going to go to this networking event or this job interview, and I'm going to get my A game on and be on fire is just ludicrous.
Like, right.
Even if you think you did a great performance, unless you're a sociopath who just has no strings pulling them in the other direction, you're going to have a hard time being like. It's like when people say, just be confident. It's like, if I could just be confident, I wouldn't be asking you for advice on how to ace this interview or do this show or get this job or go on a date. Like, I wouldn't need your advice if I could just be myself, which is what people – when people say that, what they mean is – hey, you know how we've known each other for like 15 years and we're really relaxed and you can make all those really cool, funny jokes? Just do that with total strangers with no warm up, no ramp up, no rapport. And it's like, so that's why that's not real advice.
No, it's terrible.
It's terrible
fucking advice.
Yeah.
And I think it encourages a sort of, you know, a disingenuousness that actually sets you up ultimately probably to fail more.
It does.
And, you know, well, that I'm glad you brought up sociopaths and psychopaths because Ekman brought those up. And, you know, Ekman said this, which I thought was so brilliant. He, the intellectual star fucking is really like out of control right now. But he said, you know, I can always tell when I've met a psychopath because I want to invite them to my home within 15 minutes of meeting them.
Scary.
And that is scary. And this is Ekman, who is Mr. Lie to Me, Mr. Read Facial Expressions. And the point is that psychopaths are unnaturally good at winning people over. And, you know, really sort of winning people over, you know, requires time. It requires forging that relationship. It requires establishing trust. It requires, you know, uncomfortable moments where you bury yourself in front of the group, you know, transparency, all of that. And I think part of what's interesting is to see that, you know, because you were on a genuine like path to mastery, right? I mean, 10 years, your 10,000 hours, you know, the conclusion that you ultimately come to is that it is this journey towards increasingly not faking it, right? Like, you know, there are people out there who are doing that with the whole pickup artist thing. And you're like, that's gross.
It
is. I don't want to do that. I want to actually become, you know, I mean, complete the hero's journey, right? Like, that's the goal, is to become really the person who can handle whatever's thrown at them, the universal man.
Yeah, it's a little difficult, and it makes me really, we went through a similar thing where you are right now, where it's like, although ours was arguably worse, where people hear, in fact, this happened recently. Joe Rogan said something like, he had a guest that went, oh yeah, I was on the show called The Art of Charm, and he goes, oh yeah, isn't that about those guys trying to teach other people how to get laid? And I was just like, damn this brand, you know, because like you can sit there and explain how it's different all you want. But had it been called the Jordan Harbinger Show, I probably wouldn't have to do that.
Well, I think, I mean, that's why we changed our brand. I mean, you know, it was called the Brian Callen Show because, you know, Brian was definitely the more famous of us. And then, you know, it changed it to Mixed Mental Arts precisely because we were like, we were trying to solve this problem. You know, I think I've alluded to it briefly. And these are things, by the way, that you're not supposed to do. There's this sort of culture within the podcasting community where we all sort of like aren't honest with each other, and we're all like promoting each other. And there's a lack of bluntness and all that. But, you know, and it's the same thing in the intellectual community, you know, with academics. And, you know, I'm culturally Dutch, so I could give two shits. I'd rather be blunt and, like, say what's going on in my mind. But so we had interviewed all these academics. You know, we often found that they didn't know what was going on in other fields. And then, you know, none of the ideas were adding up to each other. But also they were just such often, some of them were great, but many of them were terrible communicators. And so episode...
It's funny, freaking ironic, isn't
it? Yeah.
Like, don't you teach this to other people who teach this to people who are learning this? Yes.
And you do a shit job.
Terrible.
Shit job. And I think it's better to be honest that they're doing a shit job. Like, the break between science and the public, Atul Gawande wrote this great piece. It was his commencement speech at Caltech, The Mistrust of Science.
Right.
And it's a great piece. And, you know, his description of, you know, the evolution from being sort of a little snot-nosed brat when you get out of college or when you're in college and you're like, I know science facts, to evolving towards, like, that experimental mind of, like, constantly learning, constantly trying to improve your mental models is spot on. But the interesting thing is that, you know, Gawande lives within the culture of science. And so all of his descriptions of why the mistrust of science have happened is all like, science is complicated. There are people with interests who try and misrepresent science, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, he sort of alludes to poorly written journal articles and things like that. But, you know, why is there a mistrust of science? Because scientists are often condescending and rude to the general public and act like they know it all and the public should just believe whatever they say.
Right.
And they're terrible fucking communicators. Really, really, really bad. Not all of them, which is why when someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson shows up. When
they get fucking famous.
Yeah, exactly. Like when you get a Carl Sagan or a Neil deGrasse Tyson, it's like, holy fucking shit.
Right.
Like, let's put this guy on TV everywhere. But so episode 206 of the Brian Callen Show, Brian was there. That's right. So we interviewed Nick Bostrom. And Nick Bostrom.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So the super intelligence guy. And I read Nick's book, and, you know, it's 1,000 different ways of describing the Terminator going wrong, right?
Yeah, sure. So how AI is going to kill us. Chapters 1,000 through. Yeah.
And so, you know, and I listened to the book mostly in Mexico City, which was a weird experience because I was walking around Mexico City and listening to this, you know, I don't know, does he read it? But it's this very sort of like, whoever the reader is, it's basically like, you could think that you would put the AI inside a sandbox, but the AI is too smart for you.
It will figure out how to get out of the sandbox.
Or maybe you think the AI is like a genie and it only does what you want.
but the AI is too smart for you, so it figures its way out. And so I was like, okay, I get it. The AI is too smart. Like, it's going to outsmart us. So then we interviewed Nick Bostrom, and it's like all of that academic culture where, you know, he's super cautious, doesn't want to say anything that he can't immediately cite a study for, and just this very Swedish voice where he's like this, and he's talking like this, and da-da-da. And Brian, we're like, like, none of these ideas are ever going to move if we continue to make, you know, if we continue to respect the norms of academia and sort of keep all these little siloed fields. And so we were like, fuck it. Like, we can't get anywhere with this. And then we started doing Mixed Mental Arts, but kept going with the Brian Callen Show. And then at a certain point, we were like, okay, fuck that too. We're changing the name of the show to Mixed Mental Arts. But it's, I think that's the challenge, is that you start a podcast in one place from one position, and then inevitably you've done if you haven't changed in the course of 1,000 episodes, then, like, you got a problem.
You got problems, yeah. You got to evolve. I think it's funny. There's some sort of irony in the fact that you were reading or listening to an audiobook or a talk on how AI is going to kill you in Mexico City, where you're definitely going to die from something that's not AI related and probably very non-technological. Like
a taco.
Yeah.
Like a street taco.
Yeah.
But what a way to go, because let me tell you, those tacos al pastor in Mexico City,
they're pretty damn good.
Oh, yeah.
I used to live in Mexico City and, in fact, ate a lot of street food,
mm-hmm.
and people were like, man, you know how dangerous that is? And the funny, well, the not so funny part at the time, but funny now part was, I was like, I don't care. You know, I'm not worried about that. And I thought, like, this place isn't that dangerous. Everyone's overreacting. And that same week, I got fucking kidnapped.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Who kidnapped
you? It was a fake taxi.
Yeah,
you know,
these,
they're called express kidnappings, but at the time, I didn't know what that was. I assume that's what it was, although I have no way to know. Because what happened was, I got into a taxi. I was 20. I'm 37 now. It's mm-hmm. forever ago. So the guy didn't even have a mobile phone. In fact,
wow.
I don't think I did either, because nobody did back then, except for the guy in American Psycho. He had a mobile phone. And I got into this taxi, and we kept driving away from the center of the center of Mexico City is the Zócalo. It's the presidential palace. It's down in the middle of the bowl, because the place is shaped like a bowl and is in fact sinking. And so we kept driving up, and I thought, that's weird. And so finally I said, where are you going? And he goes, I need to get directions. And I was like, okay, that – if he'd said traffic or accident or detour or construction, maybe I would have believed him. But getting directions for a cabbie to go to the Zócalo in Mexico City is like a D.C. cabbie saying, yeah, I don't know where the White House is. Let me stop and get a map. It's just not realistic.
Yeah.
So I started to get really suspicious. And my brain was going through all of these weird gymnastics where it was like, this isn't really happening, because that would make me feel too uncomfortable, and I don't want to feel uncomfortable,
yeah.
so I'm going to pretend like it's all going to be fine and make excuses for this person and rationalize
mm-hmm.
his behavior. And then I remembered this guy on frickin' Oprah in like the 90s named Gavin DeBecker, who I've had
mm-hmm.
on my show. Have you heard of this guy? The Gift of Fear is a book he wrote.
Okay.
And it's about how your intuition is it's kind of like Malcolm Gladwell Blink, but for getting scared and worrying about stuff
mm-hmm.
and how your subconscious mind puts all these things together. And he did a great show on The Art of Charm as well about this, and how like women know when someone's going to kill them sometimes and they can act on it and escape.
Yeah.
And so I thought, wait a minute. I'm doing this rationalization thing that he talked about on Oprah, because I'd randomly come home from school and was watching that with my mom, like in 94.
No, come on, Jordan.
Okay,
you're
I'm
a huge
Oprah fan.
Yeah.
Huge Oprah fan. And so I realized, uh-oh, crap, I better, like, get out of this car. Well, the lock on the door, you know how when locks are broken on old cars, they can be underneath, not flush with the door anymore? So you can't pull it up
manually. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
just, like, under the – it just pulls in, and it's only a metal stub. It's not the plastic.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had that, and I went, oh, crap, and the doors are locked to child lock kind of thing, because it was basically a prison taxi. And I said, don't do this, you know, let me out here, I'll pay you and all this stuff. And he's like, no, we're just gonna go to my friend's house and ask for directions. And then he eventually stops, and I'm like, I can't get out, this is my like stand and fight moment. I slid behind him and put my arm between him and the door, and I was like, don't get out of the car, keep driving, because I know wherever we stop is going to be like the place where nobody will hear me scream.
Yeah.
So I put my arm between him and the door. He doesn't notice that. He makes a fast one for the door. But at that point, again, I'm 20, and I'd been taking – we didn't call it MMA back then. We didn't call it mixed martial arts. We called it, like, Kihon, which is, like, this basically Okinawan boxing type stuff.
Yeah.
So I just – and we had been taking jiu-jitsu and stuff at this point. And, again, it's the year 2000 or 2001 at the latest. I think it's still 2000. And I just choked him with the seat between us. And then I ended up – he was older, 50-year-old-plus guy – and he was swatting at me. And he, you know, when you put someone in a sleeper, they go unconscious for a little while. Crawl between the two seats. It's a Volkswagen Beetle. It's really hard to get between the two front seats of this
right.
car. Open his door, push him out, can't drive a stick, fail. So I couldn't drive the car away. Took the keys out so that he couldn't just chase me, because you wake up in like 10 seconds after you get choked
right.
out like that. Threw the keys, ran like hell as far as I could, and nobody, of course, would pick me up. I ran back to a main road. I'm sweating through my like Banana Republic shirt, and I'm a white guy in a barrio, so people
right.
were like, what are you doing here? Motorcycles were stopping, and they're like yelling at me, and like other neighbors were kind of like looking out. Old people were like, what are you doing? And I'm like, yeah, help me get out of here. And finally some guy stopped, and he was a doctor, and I thought he was with his daughter. Retrospect, probably his girlfriend.
Mm.
And I was like, I will ride in the trunk. Just get me out of here. And they were, because they didn't want to let me in their car.
Right.
But I think they saw that I was, when I was like, I will ride in the trunk. I don't care. Just get me out of here. You can drop me off anywhere else. They picked me up, and I said, take me to the police station. And they were like, pro tip, don't go to the cops.
Right.
Because they could either be in on it, or did you, you know, you said you choked out a taxi driver. Is he okay? Because you don't want to go to the police station and be like, I just murdered somebody and I'm a foreigner. So they dropped me off at a metro station, and I freaking just bounced. Like, that was my last day in Mexico City.
Wow.
So it's not always the tacos that get you.
No, it could be the express kidnapping. So what happens if they pull off the express kidnapping? What then happens?
What express kidnappings are, if memory serves, I read about them a long time ago in an article.
Well, when you've been through the experience, or almost been through the experience.
Yeah. So I would think, I'm hoping it was an express kidnapping, which is basically they kidnap you. Often a fake taxi. Then a couple of like meathead bodybuilder guys come in with knives or maybe guns or something like that. And then they go, where's your wallet? And they take you to every ATM in downtown that they can find that doesn't have cameras and cops next to it. And they make you go withdraw $500. And they make you go withdraw $300. And then make you go withdraw $1,000 and da da da. And then as soon as your card stops working, they usually just let you go, or they like you know they drop you off in the middle of nowhere and you've got to walk back 6 hours so that it's, by the time you get anything, they're gone. But I could have also ended up getting chopped up into little pieces in a basement outside of Mexico City, which is what I was thinking was going to happen at that point, which is why I didn't just go with it. Because had I just thought they're just going to rob me and I'll be fine, I might not have done anything, which is a scary thought.
But I think that's, you know, to tie this all back in, you know, that's the point, is that this social intelligence, you know, which we don't respect, you know, is actually quite good at a lot of things. It's amazing at reading situations. Also, I'll now tell you my own much less dramatic version of that story, which is that
tacos in Mexico City.
and I had the sense that the vendor was not following
health codes.
Yeah.
Was it the bucket and the dirty hands cooked over an open sewer that gave you the first sin? Man, your social intelligence is on point.
Yeah, and the flies. The flies are a big clue. No, when I first moved out here to L.A., I was going over to see somebody who lived on Yucca. And,
oh, yeah. Right up here.
Yeah. And, you know, I was on a phone call, and this was like my shitty, you know, college flip phone.
Were you walking?
I was just walking.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I figured I'd be polite and finish the call outside. So, you know, I'm on the phone, and then all of a sudden I see these two guys walking up to me with this very predatory lope. And that's what I noticed first, was the body language of this sort of like aggressive, you know, posturing.
And
you're not
thinking like heads down, eyes forward,
arms to
the side, forward head position. You're thinking like, oh, I don't like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's just this quick flash of an intuitive reaction. And then I noticed, you know, that they're African American. And so now
you racist.
Now my white guilt comes in. I say, oh, you racist. Don't be so racist. You're just stereotyping. And by the time I was about to finish these thoughts, suddenly there's a gun in my face.
Oh, shoot.
And the guy is like, where's the fucking money? Where's the fucking money? Where's the fucking money? Now, at this point, I just sort of started tutoring. And, you know,
I'm on a flip phone. I clearly do not have any money.
Yeah. And had this like super shitty backpack that I'd used for Let's Go on my back, and had literally, actually, because I just started tutoring, and I don't totally feel comfortable saying this, but, you know, had a fair amount of cash on me.
Oh, no.
And had thought, like, oh, I'm not going to leave this cash in the car
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put it in my backpack. So I literally had basically all my money in my backpack. And then he said, where's the fucking money? And just, you know, instinctually without thinking, I was like, I don't have any.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, oh, now this is really bad because I have money. He's going to find the money. I've lied to him. Oh, shit. So, you know, I'm committed to the lie. So now I just have to, like, be as calm as I can, not give him any reason to get provoked. And his buddy starts patting me down. But it's clear his buddy is nervous because the buddy pats me down. He opens up the backpack, but just sort of peeks in. He doesn't, like, go in there or look or find the cash. And then, you know, it's clear they're not getting anything out of, you know, I mean, they've literally robbed the worst guy possible. Yeah, like, I mean, they robbed someone who looks like a hobo.
Yeah, you might want to find somebody who's using, you know, not a black and white Motorola Razor.
Yeah. Idiots. No, it wasn't even that. I mean, it was much worse than that. So the guy says, give me your fucking phone, right? So I give him my phone and he starts walking away and is walking away to a getaway car that they've parked over on the curb. Looks at the phone, realizes it's a piece of shit, and then proceeds to toss it. And, like, so, you know, I wait for them to drive off, and then I go pick up my phone. And, like, I got out of the whole thing scot-free.
Pick up the phone, like, hey, Mom, sorry about that.
Well, no, but the call was still going. Oh, shit. And it was just this guy I know, BJ, and I was like, wait a minute. And he's like, did you just get mugged? Oh, shit. So that was that. But the, you know, I mean, it is that interesting so thing of, like, yeah, that social intelligence kicks in first and you read the body language. And then, you know, afterwards, that's when, you know, the sort of, you know, cultural, you know, things you've learned about don't be so racist and all that sort of stuff kick in.
It's funny, right? Because your intuition kicked in first was correct.
Yep.
Then all of this programming that we've got from all of this different social programming that we've got from growing up and being like, well, this is the problem with society is our first assumption is this. And da-da. It turned out to be right. But on the other hand, there's probably a lot of assumptions that people make that turn out to be wrong. But the difference is it's often one of articulation. And I'm just thinking of this, so pardon me while I stumble through it. But had you been able to articulate why you felt nervous about these guys, you would have made a better decision. Because had you been like, huh, okay, forward head position, eyes forward, arms down, chin down, that's a little aggressive. Oh, and also, yeah, okay, their race and ethnicity. I can isolate the variables that are actually triggering me from that versus just like someone's grandpa going, oh, there's some black kids over there. Be careful. And you're like, oh, come on, you know, grandpa, you're just an old racist. Whereas if they can say, like, no, there's other factors here that are pushing the buttons aside from skin color, or, oh, wait a minute, this isn't dangerous. I'm just feeling nervous because I'm a foreigner in a foreign place. These people aren't necessarily doing anything. I've been feeling anxious since woke up this morning. Then you can sort of hone your intuition a little bit better. Of course, the danger lies in overdoing that and then getting mugged in Istanbul or whatever.
Well, I think that's exactly the challenge. The challenge is that, you know, this is the price we pay for not teaching social and emotional intelligence in high school, in college, is that, you know, most people aren't discerning about this, right? It takes a long time to sort of become aware of what your mind is up to, what you're doing. And the, you know, it is that problem of false positives. You know, I've had this experience, right, of being mugged. But then the danger is that you then have these false positives where you start assuming all black people are this way or all young men are this way.
Because it's a thing you can actually articulate.
That's right.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, but I think what so often happens is that, you know, people talk about these things as if we should or shouldn't do this, or humanity should or shouldn't be this way. And the reality is that, you know, we're trapped. Like, we're trapped in the human condition. That is what it is. We have this social intelligence that very often works very well, but it finds the sort of false positives, the Michael Shermer lion story. And, you know, then we've got this cultural programming that kicks in on top. And sometimes that cultural programming is right. And, you know, you shouldn't make assumptions about people. But sometimes it can talk you out of listening to what the social intelligence has already figured out, like the mugging story. You know, and then, you know, you've got this fear, which can be a gift and can be useful and can get you out of a mugging situation. And so the point is that, you know, this is the problem of the human condition, and no one way is always going to be right. And, you know, part of what we talk about in Mixed Mental Arts is the wisdom to know the difference. And that's what wisdom is about, is it's being able to tell which of these factors is going on. Is it that, you know, I'm reading the body language, the head forward, the eyes downcast, is that a good read?
Or is it that, you know, I'm a massively racist individual who just assumes things about people because they have a different skin color? What is it that's really going on here?
I think there's a good midway point here for people to both, in this particular scenario, for both to stay safe and also to not reinforce negative stereotypes of, say, certain races or ethnicities. And that midway point would be, listen to your gut, listen to your intuition, but don't necessarily trust your interpretation of why you're feeling that way. So, because you could have gone, these guys look dangerous. My gut says it's because they're African American, but or at least I think that's what my gut's saying. So I'm going to act on that, but I'm not going to then continue to believe that that's the reason why. I'm just going to not care about the reason why for now and act in a way that's going to preserve my safety.
That's right.
So because you could have questioned your rationale after the fact instead of in the moment, and you wouldn't have gotten mugged.
And the great thing is that in practice in this situation, there was literally only one move for me to make, which was to freeze, stay still, and be the most compliant muggy that, you know, humanity has ever seen. Like, maybe if, you know, you are one of these guys who, you know, is like a world-class MMA guy or, you know.
You could still get shot.
Jocko Willink, yeah. You know, I could have, like, disarmed the guy and, like, stripped the gun and then been like, bam.
Right.
But that's Brian Callen in his fantasies. It's not Hunter Motz in reality.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
like,
exactly.
There's, as you know, as the sort of the tall, big-butted Dutchman, there's really only one move, which is just to be polite and dumb, which is the same strategy I always use with cops. Like, if I ever get busted for jaywalking, I act as if I'm foreign.
And do you really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. In my country, it's no problem. We can walk anywhere.
And just be, you know, really apologetic and just sort of a little wide-eyed. You know, I find that the best for this is to go full Life is Beautiful, you know, and just be like, this is amazing. Oh, I did not know this. These are the rules here. Ah, thank you, officer. And now could you tell me, where is Hollywood Walk of Fame?
Yeah.
You know, Grauman's Chinese Theater. I cannot find. Ah, pasta. Luigi Mario.
Right. And they're like, and then he's like, oh, you speak Italian? And then fluent Italian comes out and you're screwed.
Well, no, my Italian's good enough.
Okay.
You're probably bullshit. So,
bullshit. Oh, good.
But you know, in general. Yeah, you got to lean into it. And then you find out that, you know, he wants you to meet his daughter. Now you have to date his daughter. Now you're married to his daughter. And like, now you have to play this Italian character.
The shit you did to get out of an $85 jaywalking ticket.
It's amazing.
Man.
I actually had that problem in college. So, you know, freshman week, right? You have this big orientation. So our sophomore year, me and a bunch of buddies decide that we're going to pretend to be freshmen.
Oh,
and so we all, you know, so that we can get into all the events, you know, get the free drinks. Well, there's no drinks, but free ice cream. That was actually what it was for.
Sounds
that was so sad.
Sounds less and less worth it the more the story goes on.
But also, you know, we just thought it would be fun, right, to go and play a character. So, you know, we all come up with different characters. And my character was Boris Nanachenko Gorshenko, Russian math genius, right?
Great.
And I think this is all influenced by GoldenEye, the like James Bond movie where they had that character.
Yeah.
So anyway, so for the whole week, I was walking around as Boris Nanachenko Gorshenko, and they talk about back in Russia and, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, met all these people who are like, oh my God, you know, Boris, he's so fascinating. He has these great stories, like blah, blah, blah. And then at some point, we met our full-on Russian chick, and she starts speaking to me in Russian. And at this point, my buddy has to leap in and be like, no, he can't speak Russian. His English is terrible. He needs to work on his
English.
That's
a really brilliant save.
It's a really brilliant save. But the problem was is that, you know, then periodically for the next 3 years of college, I would run into someone who would be like, Boris! How are you doing, Boris? And
you're like, what's up, bro?
Yeah,
he's, dang,
exactly.
Your English is so
much
good.
Better. So sometimes, yeah, these things do get you in trouble.
Can you help me with my math homework? No, man.
No.
I failed pre-calculus.
So anyway, but yeah, I think it's interesting because I think, you know, we've been coming at this from very different angles. You know, you've been coming at like, how does this apply in terms of business? How does this apply in terms of networking? How does this get me a job? You know, how does this get me into a relationship and a really satisfying one? And then, you know, Brian and I have been, you know, coming at this through the lens of academia, but in many senses, we've arrived at the same, you know, destination of, you know, we're good at social artificial intelligence. That's humanity's superpower. And then what the fuck do we do about that? How do we handle this brain? How do we handle this human mind that, you know, is clearly, I mean, we're sitting here, you know, using technology. It's clearly good at solving problems, but can also create problems. And how do we manage this piece of wetware?
I like that you're calling it humanity's superpower. I'm literally going to write this down right now because I'm like, where can I insert that into The Art of Charm? That's
the thing that I really want to popularize is that IQ test chart from Joe Henrich's book. Because to me, it's again, like in the same way that you're having to say, you don't have to believe me on this. You know, you take an image like that and then you force people to engage with that. You want to deny that this is true? Here's the science in one picture that clearly shows that social intelligence is what we are born being good at. Now, obviously, as we pick up culture, you know, we learn math and we become better at math than chimps. And, you know, we learn causal reasoning.
Speak for yourself.
Well, you know, I mean, Coco the gorilla really is doing some amazing work in, you know, multivariable calculus.
Non-Euclidean geometry.
But, you know, we come to learn these things, but it's that baseline social intelligence. And for me, that always solves, you know, coming from a very nerd world, there's always this weird thing where, you know, we were told, oh, it's all about books. You have to learn books. Books is how you do this. But then there was always this uncomfortable truth, this uncomfortable group of people like Dave, people who were street smart and who are really good at networking and relationships, who way outperformed the nerds in terms of business, in terms of, you know, real world success, innovation. You know, Richard Branson is a great example of that. And Richard Branson and I had the same history teacher.
Really?
Separated by decades.
Yeah, that's but that's cool though.
But it was great because my history teacher was the guy who told Richard Branson that he would never amount to anything.
No.
He was that guy.
What does he have to say about that now?
Well, I think it's sort of like it becomes one of those weird things where it now becomes a badge of pride.
Right.
Because, you know, still you're connected to this famous person.
Yeah, every day on the first day of class you tell the story about how you told Richard Branson he's never gonna make anything out of himself.
And he was this amazing guy. We called him, I can't remember what his actual name, but we called him Long John Silver because his name was like Mr. Long or something like that.
Gotcha.
But he used to play hockey a lot, and he had severed the nerve in his like main finger or something
that.
So what that meant is he had no feeling in this. So he would go and he would rap his knuckles so hard on the desk, and his real thing where he would do it with his pointed finger, like just like he's flipping the bird, but like pounding the table, and he would just go, "No moral backbone, moral jellyfish." And you know, you can just imagine him going, "You'll never amount to anything, Branson." And
wow.
So, you know, it became this badge of honor. Could you get him to say that you were worthless and a piece of shit? Because that was some sort of prediction.
Then you
success.
Might end up, yeah, you might end up like Branson. The more Long John Silver hates you.
Exactly. The more successful you'll be.
Yeah.
You know, but the Branson figures, I mean, they really don't fit into the traditional academic narrative about like being on that path. And, you know, I mean, I think that's so much of, you know, essentially what you realized in the beginning of Art of Charm was that, like, hey, there's this thing that I've been told by my culture about how you succeed. And then there's the actual proof of Dave.
Yeah, good point.
You know, there's Branson. There's all these people. And the point is, I think that really what Dave and Richard Branson and all these other people have figured out, and there are other ones that I know personally, is that, you know, they figured out humanity's superpower. And they figured out that it is about relationships and it is about working with other people and that it is about learning and, you know, but learning socially, paying attention to what are other people doing, reading body language, figuring out what's up with people.
That's really a good point. The fact that social intelligence is humanity's superpower and the fact that you're right, there's a lot of conventional wisdom where people say you just have to work hard and you just have to show up and you just have to, you know, work on your skill set. That stuff is true, that you do need to do that, but the fact that the idea that you just need to do that is wrong. And I grew up in Michigan with a dad who worked at a Ford plant and a mom who was a public school teacher. So their ideas about what was the way to get ahead was look, you work hard, you study, you go to college, and mm-hmm. then you're going to get a job. I mean, very, you know, you're going to get a college education. You'll have a job, and you'll be fine. And that was totally valid up until, I don't know, 1985 or 90 or something. There were people who were great with their social intelligence that moved up to the top of sales or even executives. But to be successful in the world as it occurred to my and appeared to my parents, they were pretty correct on that. The problem is that now you really can't be guaranteed anything unless you know how to get people to know, like, and trust you, get them to really feel an affinity for you, want to work with you, want to help you, that type of thing. Get them enrolled in your ideas. And you're right. Unless you're a sociopath, you probably have some manual work to do in terms of studying those skills.
Well, and crucially, I think in deprogramming yourself from your culture, because if you'd grown up, you know, in another culture, you wouldn't have to unlearn so many things. And there's a lot of intuitions that you have to unlearn about what matters and what's important and, you know, what to have a there's a tendency to have a judgment on, you know, like people part of that sort of, you know, lack of confidence is people sort of talk themselves out of it. They talk themselves out of, you know, oh, what are people going to think of me? Like, do I seem pushy or do I seem like I'm selling myself too much? As opposed to just doing it genuinely from a place of like, I want to be a service. I want to connect. How can I help you achieve your goals?
Exactly. That you summed it up really well there. And you're right. There's a lot of the cultures that have, I would say, a negative impression of people who have a who
put
try
themselves
to achieve
it, out
put themselves
there.
Out there. Yeah. The tall poppy gets cut. That was the phrase I was looking for. And that there's an Australian sort of thing where that happens. But when you look at Asian cultures and things like that, where not only is it you shouldn't be out achieving people, but you can't even make yourself remotely important. Yep. You have to always subordinate yourself to people based on age or something like that. So those guys and girls, when they come through the Art of Charm program, that's when we're like, oh my gosh, we're not even just teaching you how to be more charismatic and magnetic. We're trying to teach you that it's even okay to do mm-hmm. this. And it's a really big win when we're able to do that, because a lot of frankly, those people just needed permission to be a little bit more open and outgoing. But it's hard to do after you've grown up with 30 years of don't look people in the eye. It's a little rude. Yep. Don't try to outachieve people. If you do achieve something, keep it a secret. Don't tell anyone. That doesn't work in this in the westernized version of academic performance or corporate performance. I mean, if you're a lawyer and you do a bunch of great work and you make sure that nobody knows about it, you're going to get fired. Somebody else will gladly take credit for the project you've done.
Well, and we've been talking a lot about sort of, you know, cultural evolution, right? That's what Joe Henrich's book, The Secret of Our Success, is about. And, you know, Asian cultures, for example, evolved for rice farming, which is, you know, very, you know, water runs down from your neighbor's paddy field into your paddy field and then runs down to the next field. So you have to, like, get along with everyone. And so it's about fitting in and belonging. And, you know, I mean, the Japanese version of the tall poppy is, you know, the nail that sticks up gets hammered down. Ah. And my favorite, though, is the Chinese one, which is the loudest duck gets shot.
Really? I've never heard that one.
Yeah,
I wonder.
There's a book by, I think it's Laura Lisswood, and she talks about this. The loudest duck gets shot is the name of her book. But, you know, there's a real problem there. And then, you know, there's also a problem in Western culture where sometimes there's such a desire to stand out that you're very bad at working within a team. And so, you know, it's this ability to know when is it time to be the loud duck and when is it time to work with the group. And, you know, that's what Lisswood talks about. And, you know, she draws this great distinction between, you know, the time to stand out and the time to speak up is if there's a fire, right? This is not time to, like, debate and discuss everything and form consensus. You're just like, there's a fire. You're doing this. You do this. You do this. And then at other times when, you know, you have to reach sort of complex decisions, that's when you want to have that sort of consensus making where you're building the wisdom of crowds and you're sort of really, you know, hearing from everyone and testing and workshopping the ideas. But the problem is that our cultures program us to sort of blindly do one or the other without being discerning about which tool is the right tool for the situation and when to do one or the other.
That's fascinating. What was the book called that teaches us how our culture or how our economies shape the culture? And then
we'll share a reading list. So the first thing is, you know, Joe Henrich's The Secret of Our Success is about cultural evolution.
Okay.
It's a little bit academic-y, but well worth a read, and there are some amazing examples in there, like why Polish is full of consonants and Hawaiian is so full of vowels.
Really?
And it's because of the environment, again, because with a language like Polish, you're indoors all day, and you're cold, and you're speaking at close distance. So that sort of language, which is, you know, I mean, the ultimate word is, excuse me, in Polish is przepraszam. So it's like...
Got it.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, you know, you've got Hawaiian, which is mahalo, right? Aloha. It's very sonorous. It has these big open vowels. And that's because they'd be outdoors. And they'd be speaking in the open air, and the wind would be blowing. And so you need sound that carries well across distances. So you can predict how a language sounds based on essentially, you know, these four conditions of temperature, wind speed, you know, and
that's freaking cool.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
So there's these very cool examples like that. But what it does is it gives you this framework of understanding that, you know, cultural evolution has happened. Our cultures have been shaped to certain environments. And the problem is that, you know, we're now in a different environment. We're in the environment of the information age. And as you said, you know, 1985, right? You know, up until that point, you could really just, it was, you know, learn skills, and you could use those skills for the rest of your career. But now we're reaching the end of routine work. And anything that is routine, whether it's, you know, manning a cash register or driving a truck or even a lot of legal work, is now being done by software or robots or computers. And so routine work aren't the skills that you can sell. And so, you know, what we've been calling this is the jobocalypse, right?
There's this jobocalypse
happening. And the question is, how do you survive and thrive in that environment? And Alvin Toffler, the futurist, nailed that problem where he said, you know, the illiterate of the 21st century are those who can't learn, unlearn, and relearn. And that's the ability. And, you know, we talk about like putting the white belt on. You just have to every day, you know, you don't know what the environment is, and then you just have to learn as much as you can. You just have to do whatever you can to improve, and you have to take whatever opportunities you can. But that's the culture that really serves the 21st century, is just constantly doing that of like, okay, today is a new day, unfamiliar territory. I just, you know, keep learning and learning and learning and evolving and evolving and evolving. And that's the real key. It's being in a state where you can constantly evolve based on whatever is thrown at you.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I'm still just so amazed by some of the linguistic stuff. I geek out hard for language stuff. So that man, I think you're right, though. And I don't know, you said someone else had coined this term, the illiterate of the 21st century.
Yeah, Alvin Toffler, the futurist.
Yeah, I think that couldn't be more true. I mean, we see the people, when I casually observe people, and again, I'm not an academic who's done a broad study of this, when I see people who aren't doing as well, it's usually because they have something that they just can't seem to let go of, mm-hmm. mentally, emotionally, some sort of mindset where they're just like, no, it's supposed to work this way. And they build resentment around that, which causes them to double down on that mindset, which is not serving them. And you see that a lot, especially mm-hmm. with older folks. And I don't mean old, I mean 50s and 60s, who have been in a job for a while and are now starting to face maybe automation. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, no, it's not fair. And it's like, well, every second you waste lamenting about this being unfair is a second that you're not learning a different trade that might be more beneficial.
That's right.
And it's easy for me to say, being in a like independent media role or something like that. But bear in mind, I was an attorney before, and I was very much aware of the fact that I was checking for commas in documents and mm-hmm. was overpaid for doing so, and that monkeys could do most of that, and that even some of the advanced legal work and thinking and synthesis will and can and should be done by AI that can go through everything in LexisNexis in 14 milliseconds and throw all the relevant case law into a document, print it out for me to look at, and then even a judge might go, oh, yeah, the AI is correct in the conclusion here. This is definitely how it should be. And then they maybe throw in a little human element of empathy or sympathy, because mm-hmm. we might need that as a check on our robo-justice system. But basically, I mean, you know, we're looking at things like even the most complex argumentation can eventually be done by an artificial intelligence, and it just won't look as good on Law and Order.
No, of course not. Although, I mean, you know, you can imagine it really, like, imagine.
Or
one
maybe
of the,
it'll look awesome.
Yeah,
on
imagine one of the Cylons, like six from Battlestar Galactica. I mean, if, you know, if she was the prosecuting attorney, what judge could say no?
That's
especially
right.
when her spine lights up.
and you've lost me.
Yeah. Anyway, that was really nerdy. But it, I think the key thing too is that you don't have to be an academic to make sense of this stuff. The point is that, you know, all we're doing now is trying to rationally understand what humans intuitively do well, right? So, you know, you're able to suss out, like, our brains are evolved to be able to spot, oh, you know, Ogo over there is really holding on to this grudge that he has against Bajuba, and therefore, you know, oh, that's a problem. We got to deal with that. So the community is very good. The tribe is very good at picking up when the social dynamics are off so that they can spot and solve problems before they lead to, oh, now we're all killing each other.
Right, yeah.
So I think that's the key thing is that often, again, these are these weird cultural notions that we have to unprogram ourselves from, is that, you know, we have to be realistic that science is amazing. I love science. But we also have to understand that, you know, sometimes it can lead to us denying the things that our brain is good at spotting. Like, you imagine in the sort of the lion situation, you know, if you were like, oh, I'm not a scientific expert, so I'm not really qualified
right.
to make a decision. Is this Jim in the bushes or is this a lion in the bushes? So I want to withhold judgment and not really make a claim one way or the other until we have some empirical evidence. Because by the time you have empirical evidence, you're dead.
Yeah, that type of academic thought process can only exist in a place and time where we're so secure that we can afford to dick around all the time.
Yeah, and I think that that place and time is now over precisely because of the jobocalypse and because of all the disruption that's happening. You know, we have a real problem on our hands, which is that we have, you know, 7 billion people. And we now live in a work environment and in a world which most of them are not suited for. And so you now have to, you know, you take everything you can from everything that we've learned from all different places and times. And then we now have to really start. And I think a lot of it is just going to have to be peer to peer. It's going to have to be bottom up. It's not going to come from the top. The leadership that we have right now sucks. So it's going to have to be us having conversations
yeah.
like this and, you know, just sort of unfucking each other up.
Being yeah.
like, that's so much.
Tall order.
That is a tall order. But that is, I think, what it comes down to is, you know, this is how humans resolve problems is that, you know, we're like, I'm shitty at this. You're good at this. Teach me. For example, Hunter does not know how to use his Zoom. Now he better knows how to use his Zoom because Jordan, who is much better at running a successful podcast business, has explained these things to him. So, you know, and the listeners will benefit because the audio will be better.
So I do have a question about that yeah. from before. Sort of we're going to talk about some podcasting stuff that I think we just immediately went like and
yeah.
went off in a different direction. But how – I mean, you guys have a ton of listeners, right? Mm. So how have you not managed to like turn that into at least a break-even proposition?
Well, that is a real tribute to just like the scope of our lack of business acumen and also just what our priorities have been. Our
sure.
priorities have really just been like having cool conversations.
Yeah, good
yeah.
on you. That's
yeah.
worked out so far
yeah.
really well.
And so now the goal is really to, you know, what we want to do is we want to, you know, really change the culture, really move these ideas. And so we've just realized that in order to do that effectively, we're going to have to, for example, we want to make this video series called Culture Matters, which is just 10 short videos that are essentially are knowledge bombs, where people can go and drop them on each other's feeds and have conversations, because there are a lot of conversations that humanity has been avoiding having for a long time. You know, you're not supposed to talk about culture or, you know, not supposed to admit that, oh, you know, other, you know, especially as white men, right, you're not supposed to say, oh, there might be problems with other cultures, right?
Right, yeah. It's,
it's taboo, right? And so, you know, the way you solve that is just by generalizing and making it a shared human experience where it's like, hey, the experience of being human is we all pick up culture from our environment. And that culture is sometimes helpful and sometimes hurtful. A lot of my culture is Dutch. And one of the advantages is that we're blunt. And we say what nobody else is saying. It's also the disadvantage because we routinely, you know, offend people or rub people the wrong way. Or, you know, for example, if if you want to talk about a nation that could most use the art of charm, it is the Dutch.
The Dutch. We do get a lot of Dutch students here in LA at our residential program. With the house that you're in right now, which no one can see, is we're above we're next to / above our classroom where people come in and learn a lot of the skills that I'd mentioned earlier. And we do get a lot of Europeans. And one of the main things that the Western Europeans tend to come in with is the idea that, well, it's really weird if you just start talking with people, or it's really weird if you try to form a friendship with somebody that you just met, that you don't know, that you don't work with, that you don't go to school with, that you didn't grow up with. That's so strange for them. So when we kind of untether them from that, then they're just like, so it's okay for me to go up and talk to random people because I find them interesting. Yes. And they just, it's like a launch, you know?
Totally.
It's like when you're squeezing two magnets together that are repelling each other, and then you suddenly let go and one just flips and fires off in that direction. That's what I feel like a lot of the European guys are like.
That is so much of the experience of like breaking out of some cultural bullshit, whatever the cultural bullshit is. But yeah, the Dutch are a people who could definitely benefit from listening to all 1,000 episodes of The Art of Charm. But so I think that's the key is, you know, so, you know, we now want to make this video series, and, you know, it's really to empower our listeners to be able to go and then, you know, start these conversations, because we're not going to, it's an unreasonable expectation to say, oh, by the way, humanity, like, so we can have this conversation, you need to read these super academic,
right.
The Secret of Our Success by Joe Henrich, all of the work of Richard Nisbet, Thomas Sowell, you know.
Reading list. 3 years of dry shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, and we have that reading list, and, you know, it's done some good, and some people are engaged, but we need to give people better tools to be able to spread that message and to start those conversations, and that means we need to be getting some sort of money or revenue.
Sure, yeah, of
just because video production costs some money. So the point is that now we're like, okay, we're going to sell t-shirts and, you know, we'll do Patreon and we'll do all these other things and, you know, probably start doing live podcasts and all of that.
What about ads? How come you don't have like, you know,
these are great
apron questions.
These are great questions, Jordan. And that's, I think, part of what I would like to get into is, you know, that you've built a successful podcast business. And one of the things that we want to empower people to do is we have this idea of being good ISIS. So there's bad ISIS and they go around and they operate as, you know, terror cells and they chop people's heads off. We want to be good ISIS. And we want to inspire, instead of terror cells, salons or mixed mental arts dojos
yeah.
around the world. And crucially, because I think the, you know, so much of this does come down to language communities. Like, these ideas do not diffuse into the Arab world in particular. You know, the UN has this report on, you know, building a knowledge society in the Arab world. And the statistic they give in there is that since the year 1000, the same number of books have been translated into Arabic as are translated into Spanish in 1 year.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And there are, I think, 10 million Greek speakers, people who speak Greek, and then something like 400 million Arabic speakers. And 5 times as many books are translated into Greek as are translated into Arabic as 1 year.
Wow. And we don't even think about the, like, oh, I hope this gets translated into Greek.
Yeah.
It's an afterthought language.
That's right.
So when you think about Spanish and German and French and stuff,
yep.
and Japanese or, you know, Chinese, the amount of things that are being translated and created in those cultures is enormous. And yet, wow. Why is that? I mean, is that just because of the regimes that are involved?
Well, it's partly, I mean, copyright, right? You have all these different countries. They all have their different censorship rules. So if you're a publisher and you're looking at that landscape, you're like, ooh, 400 million
yeah.
people, but what a pain in the ass. It's also the language itself. I mean, Arabic, right, as a language is, you know, I mean, if you listen to Moroccan Arabic and compare it to Egyptian
yeah,
Arabic, compare
right.
it to Levantine Arabic,
or
there's pretty big differences. And then also, and these are things you're not supposed to talk about, but if you talk to most Arabs, you'll hear that they don't actually read a lot. It's not a big reading culture.
Oh, really?
This is things that, you
That's
know,
strange.
Places like the well, it's strange historically because, of course, the you know, the first word, right, that the angel Gabriel says, the first revealed word in the Quran is read.
Really?
It's literally the first
freaking
word.
Irony of that
yeah.
is a little bit much.
Yeah, so, you know, they're up in the cave, and then basically, you know, the angel Gabriel comes up behind Muhammad and squeezes him and says, read.
And, you know, Muhammad says, I don't know how to read. And he says, read. And then he says, I don't know how to read. And then the words start pouring forth in Revelation. But he's literally reading from the sacred text. But so, you know, and if you look at the first 400 years of Islam, I mean, you know, it's at the forefront of all the sciences. It's hyper-literate.
Yeah.
You know, it's an incredibly literate. You have the House of Wisdom in Baghdad. And so, you know, actually, I should really go into it. Baghdad.
Yeah.
but, you know, it's this hyper-literate culture. And then there is this moment called the closing of the gates of Ijtihad, where it's essentially they decide that everything that has been known, that can be known, has been known. And they basically are like, boom, no more investigation.
Yep. We're done.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a real battle between different factions at the time. And there was a faction that, you know, was really pro learning everything from the outside world. And then there's this faction that closes the doors, and the faction that closes the doors wins. But I think, you know, there's a danger of a global closing of the gates of Ijtihad. You look at what's going on academic campuses. You look at a lot of what's, you know, there's this famous book, The Closing of the American Mind. And if you look around, there's, you know, there's a real danger, I think, in this moment that, you know, there's two ways it can go. Right. There's the possibility that we close the gates and there is this sort of drawing down and this death of, you know, sort of intellectual inquiry. And then there's the other possibility of a second enlightenment. And, you know, that's a large part of what we want to do. But part of it is that, you know, I'm not going to be an effective change agent in a lot of other cultures. Also, my Arabic is
well, you can change that.
But it's probably easier to inspire people in other cultures to set up their own podcasts and to disseminate those ideas and to be able to package it in ways that are culturally appropriate. And so that's the great work, is to take all of these ideas and repackage them and reinvent them in a way that different demographics can do.
Yeah, I mean, that's more scalable, certainly. Yeah. Unless you're going to write a book that 400 million Arabic speakers are suddenly going to read.
They're not.
Which is unlikely.
Yep.
To ever happen.
Yeah.
Unless, yeah.
It's not going to happen. So I think part of what, you know, I'd love to hear from you is, you know, if what would you say to people looking to start a podcast in somewhere like the Arab world or Afghanistan or France or Spain or China, wherever?
You have to hide the broccoli. That's what I would say. I normally try to talk people out of starting a show because I think most people nowadays who start shows, especially in the States, Western world, they want to become like thought leaders and they want to be influencers. And it's the same thing as wanting a million Instagram followers. It doesn't do you any good other than like this vanity metric that makes you feel cool. But if you were in Afghanistan or if you're in Iraq or if you're in Syria and you want to start a show, hiding the broccoli is a term we use at The Art of Charm, because when you try to get a little kid to eat broccoli, a baby, toddler, you have to put cheese all over it. And then they're just like, yeah, I'm eating this cheese and it's amazing. And they're like, I can't believe I'm just going to sit here and eat all this cheese. Cheese whiz, preferably. Not even real cheese. Because real cheese, you know, why waste real cheese on some kid? He's just going to inhale it. Unless it's your kid. I don't know how we get on the topic. No, but you got to hide the broccoli because when you're trying to teach people ideas that are going to resist that programming, right, you're holding the two magnets together, and when you're trying to get them to release the cultural programming that's going to allow the other person to fly and take off with it, you really have to couch it in something that's more palatable than, here's this thing that's going to make you think really hard, and it's going to challenge you. And because some people will say they want that, but really they kind of want a little bit of that, and then they want to go listen to somebody make jokes and crack, you know, make TV dramas and stuff. So we call it hiding the broccoli. And what we do at The Art of Charm is one of the most common questions that we get in our mailbox, in my inbox, is how do I get my friends to listen to AOC? How do I get my friends to listen to the AOC?
Yep.
He needs it. She needs it. She loves it. My dad needs it. All this. And it's never about the value that the show brings. It can never be, well, it teaches you all this great stuff about nonverbal communication and negotiation and persuasion techniques and influence. And nobody will really act on that. Mm-hmm. I always just say, tell people it's funny, which is like not totally true in many cases. I mean, some of it's funny, but I'm not sitting there trying to be funny the whole time. It's not a comedian, so it's not a comedy podcast. So if you, but people find that when they say these guys are hilarious, that people go, "Great, what is it?
Yeah,
The Art of Charm. Okay, I'm subscribed now." And then they listen and they're like, "All right, well, that wasn't that funny. I guess I'll listen to another one." Well, that wasn't that funny, but it is interesting.
Yeah.
You know, you got to hide the broccoli. So if you're in Iraq and Afghanistan, Syria, whatever, Lebanon, and you want to start a show and it's going to be about politics or religion or cultural commentary, do a little bit of humor, not too much, mm-hmm. and then tell people that it's going to be funny and lighten the right. mood. And then you'll conversion rate will be 100 times better
right.
than it would be if you just told people that it's going to be about changing the way you think about the world or your life or something heavy duty yep. like that.
So it's Mary Poppins, right? A spoonful of sugar helps right. the medicine go down.
Yes, exactly.
And the key is that what you do is that you sell people on the sugar and then they don't even realize that they've drunk the medicine.
Yeah, good point. Right, yep. exactly. You sell them on the sugar and it's like, I like funny stuff and I yeah. trust my friends, so they download it and they go, oh, okay. Oh, well, all right, fine. And then they don't care at that point because they either go, yeah, I didn't really agree with that. It wasn't that funny. And they never subscribe, or they go, this is awesome. And they don't go, but it's not funny. You lied to me.
Right.
Because they know what's going on or they don't care.
Right.
It's fine.
So then there you go. That's amazing. And I think the other thing, too, is that it's not just going to be for, you know, the Arab world or, you know, France or South America. I mean, I would also say the red states, too.
Yeah, definitely.
Because, I mean, it's been interesting, like post-Rogan, a lot of people who have been reaching out have been, you know, people from Appalachia, the Rust Belt, sort of the hillbilly culture who, you know, have read Hillbilly Elegy and they already know that there's cultural factors going on there. And, you know, it's interesting because I think that's such a great venue as well for, you know, this sort of cultural reawakening, because so many people in the Midwest, you know, you talked about, you know, your dad works at Ford Plant.
Yeah, from Michigan.
Yeah, my uncle works at the Ford. My uncle Bill works at the Ford plant in Blue Springs, Missouri. And, you know, I mean,
Missouri,
which is how you say it.
Right.
But that's the key thing is that, you know, it was always growing up for me, you know, I had the opportunity to go to, you know, all these amazing schools like Eton. And then I went to Harvard. And then, you know, you had my cousins who
explained so much.
What?
All the accents you do.
Oh,
and
yeah,
everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know, my cousins, you know, they grew up in Kansas City and they just had a different set of and frame of exposure. And it was weird for me because it was clear to me that there wasn't any difference in our intelligence or our ability. It was just, you know, my horizons were different because of the exposure that I had and what I thought was possible for me.
Interesting / kind of depressing at the same time.
Well, but I think the opportunity is that now we have, you know, the internet and you can use the internet to, you know, I've been using, because of Kansas, The Wizard of Oz, right? So there's that great scene in The Wizard of Oz where Toto pulls back the curtain on the wizard. And we see that there is no magic. And, you know, the most important thing, I had a conversation with one of my students who went to Stanford. And, you know, he was asking me, you know, what do you think is the most important thing you got out of going to Harvard? And it was really that Steve Jobs thing of realizing that the world was built by people who are no smarter than you. And, you know, I went to school with Mark Zuckerberg. Like, he was there at the same time. And I was like, oh, that's Randy's brother, that little snot-nosed shit. Right? And it utterly removes the mystery from it. You're like, oh, that guy was kind of dorky. Right? And, you know, you weren't like talking to Mark or, you know, I don't know if I ever did talk to Mark, but it wasn't that you met the Zuckerberg clan or whatever and we're like, these people are geniuses.
Right, right.
You're just like, oh, this kid's into computers. Like, he does that. That's his thing, right? And, you know, that's the nature of, I think, going to one of those schools is that it's people who have these exposure and they have this sense of, you know, what an ordinary human being can do. And so, you know, you meet Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, you're like, oh, Bill Gates went here. And you're like, oh, and these are all these famous professors. And that guy, my Chem 10 teacher, won a Nobel Prize. And so, you know, you're like, he seems like a human being. Like, I bet that he works hard at his chemistry thing. And if you did that for decades and decades and decades, you would do something that nobody else had ever done before. And just increasingly, you know, you meet more and more of these people and the mystery goes out of it and you understand and you just sort of come to generalize the principle that if you persisted in this, you would be able to do this. And I think that's a large part of what, you know, the job that I've taken on for myself is just to give everybody that experience so that everybody can realize there are no magic humans. There isn't sort of being naturally born smart at anything. It's just that, you know, if you grow up and you're around these people, like it's, you know, what's the biggest predictor of whether somebody becomes a professional athlete? Being in a family that is full of professional
Did
athletes.
Did not know yeah. that. That's and totally makes sense, though.
Then it's the family business.
Yeah.
And you're like, Mo, I know what the things are I have to do. And, you know, there's a real clarity and everybody's very clear and there's that direct mentorship. So, you know, it's what do you think is possible for you? Or, you know, there's Dan Coyle's book, The Talent Code, which talks so much about talent clusters, where, you know, how many female Russian tennis players were there 20 years ago? None. And then Anna Kournikova comes along and suddenly it's possible. And all these young Russian girls are like, I want to be the next Anna Kournikova.
Right, sure.
Except in a Russian accent.
In a Russian accent,
so
yeah.
They're like, I want to be next Anna Kournikova. And so they have the Spartak Tennis Academy, which is this one tennis school in Moscow, which just, you know, is a talent factory.
It's a machine. Like yep. One of those classic socialist sort of communist things where it's like, we take the baby away from mother and turn to tennis profession.
Yeah. So, you know, the point is that it's what do you think is possible for you and what do you have exposure for? But, you know, and a large part of what I do is, you know, I've been calling myself Toto. And, you know, I pull back the curtain, but you can do this for yourself. So I think it's incredibly valuable. This is an exercise that Carol Dweck recommends. You know, you pick somebody who you're utterly in awe of, you know, who's your hero. And then rather than just sort of staring at them and being in awe of them, go read some biographies about them. Go find out about their life. Find out about their process. What was it that caused them to sort of understand this way of thinking or to see opportunities that nobody else saw? You know, what are the values? And then you start to realize, oh, this is a path that I can follow. This is a thing that I can do. And that's that Steve Jobs quote, right? When you realize the world is built by people no smarter than you, then you realize that you can do whatever you want. And that's the greatest day of your life. And, you know, it's in some senses, it's depressing that up until now, that hasn't been
right,
an experience that,
that
everybody else has been able to know. But the point is that that's the nature of human progress is that, you know, you realize the things that we've been doing wrong and the ways in which we haven't been serving the next generation, and then we do better. And doubtless, we're going to fuck a whole bunch of shit up.
Yeah. So far, so good on that.
And then they will come to find even better ways of doing it. So I haven't even been paying attention to the time.
Yeah.
Jesus, an hour and 30. Yeah. Wow.
I was like, I'm pretty sure, yep, in 1 minute I have like a call or something like that.
Yep, but that's amazing. Well, anyway, Jordan, this has been fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on Mixed Mental Arts. And everybody, the show is Art of Charm with Jordan Harbinger. And then is there anything else you'd like to plug?
Yeah, look, you're listening to a podcast, check out the Art of Charm podcast. And you can also, we have a lot of challenges and things like that and little missions and practical exercises. I'm very big on practicals, mm-hmm. and so are we in general here at AOC. We'll send a bunch of stuff on influence, persuasion, body language, nonverbal communication if people want to go check that out at theartofcharm.com/challenge or just go to theartofcharm.com. But honestly, just check out the podcast, and I'm a happy camper.
And it's a funny podcast.
Yeah, right. It's hilarious.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. Talk to you soon.
You've been listening to Mixed Mental Arts with Brian Callen and Hunter Motz. For more information and past episodes, please visit briancallen.com and mixedmentalarts.club. Also, be sure to follow the show on Twitter @MixedMentalArts. Until next time, bye-bye.